This is fun! The FU Network!
Hi, this is Neil Wadowich. Welcome to the Zodcast on FU Politics. This week, I'm going to be trying something a little different. I'm going to be introducing a new co-host, Lauren Griffith. As well, I'm going to be speaking with Canadian journalist Max Fawcett and autism advocate Aline. Please enjoy the show.
Nero before Zod!
Griffith, welcome to the Zodcast. I'm hoping that you're going to be on regularly, and you can add a bit of, non-Neilness to this, which would be excellent. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Thank you very much for having me, and if you will have me on again, I will be very happy to come back. So self-summaries for me are very bad. I'm a mom. I'm just like your average everyday person, but I have decided to stop being apathetic to politics. So just starting to get engaged, and it's become extremely immersive. And here we are now. Somehow I've managed to end up on the Zodcast. So turns out apathy doesn't really get you anywhere.
No. And I don't know if I've ever been apathetic towards politics. I don't think I have been as vocal, you know, to people who aren't my children and wife and pets and such, you know. Mm-hmm. Podcasting and being on Twitter has kept me from arguing with strangers on the street. So, you know, now I get to argue with the sock puppet on panel shows, which is quite excellent. And no offense to Ed the Sock, I'm thankful. Right now we are on the on FU Politics on the FU Network, the 4U Network. So I believe you had your first experience on that. How did that go, Lauren?
I did. It was actually super, super fun. I definitely took it a little bit more seriously. I was like, oh, I'm gonna go do all this research and figure it out and all that stuff, but we ended up talking about the slogans of the parties and how effective they were and all that sort of stuff. And it was good. It was fun. So much more laid back. Like, I had a sheet of notes ready to go, and I think I looked at like one thing just to make sure my numbers were accurate. But other than that, it was just like sitting in a room with a bunch of your friends, just, you know, talking. And that is way easier to get into than to try and figure out the terms that they're using first to understand what they're actually trying to tell you.
So, and I found that it can be a dog-eat-dog format. Mm-hmm. I was like you the first time I went on. I mean, for anything I do when I'm on podcasts, I generally have notes ready. I have what I want to say. I try and figure those things out, but that piece of paper went out the window in about 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. You know, yep. They started talking about Jessica Yaniv and the fight started, or the debate started, and mm-hmm. you know, everything kind of went to I guess I wasn't prepared the first time. I think I may have said about 5 or 6 words on the first one. The second time I came out a little bit more prepared. I thought you sounded absolutely great.
Well, thank you very much.
That was kind of my idea, you know, to bring on a co-host and, you know, to, especially with the election coming up, I want to have people on who can talk about what they're seeing, you know, what the election is going to be like for them. Yes. And also, you have a funny account, and you made me laugh the other night when we were with your little tete-a-tete with Mike the Canstrillian.
Yes, that was funny. I love those D-gens. I love them so much. And I mean D-gens in the, like, most flattering of terms. It's like, these are the only people that I will call degens with a smile on my face. They are too funny.
Oh, him and Gordy, and especially when you get Steve Panwasi.
Oh, I die every time.
But, yeah, no, and any of your threads can turn into an absolute sideshow. There's a serious one where I have bots attacking me, and then I have Mike and Gordy and Steve being irreverent on the other part. It makes Twitter worth it.
Oh, it does, for sure. There was probably at least a solid month where I would just check Twitter just for their threads. Like, what they end up getting into with their tangents is so beyond what the original post was. I love it so much, especially when it happens on the conservative posts. I can only imagine what the social media team has to deal with. Like,
well, we know the Conservative Party social media team are likely a bunch of 7-year-olds, right? So, you know, they're probably going like, I know you are, but what am I? Or,
yep,
dude, your mom's fat, or whatever that type of. Although I think I shut him down with my dinner theater production of Magic Mike that I asked him to be in the other night. So that was nice.
Oh, can't wait for that.
So we have the writ dropping on the 2019 federal election. And I can't help but seeing all these people on Twitter talking about dropping the writ. It makes it sound like it's like a rap shout out for white people. You know, I'm going to drop the writ on you.
Yeah.
It's really a bunch of people saying that phrase that they must love saying it, you know, drop the writ. So I call it calling an election, but you know, I guess people want to get all labely and wordy on us. Mm-hmm. So what are your feelings going into this campaign? How do you feel at the outset?
Honestly, it's still a bit of a toss up, right? Because something that Ed had said was that around this time in the polls, Justin Trudeau was like dead last. So I'm not sure. At the very least, I don't want anybody to get complacent with anything, right? Like, I don't want anybody to say that, oh, it's going to be a surefire win. We'll at least get like a minority government or something like that. Everybody needs to go out and vote and, you know, make sure that you get yourself engaged on this. On this issue in particular, I haven't been following that whole drop the writ thing because I've been kind of a little bit more focused on a particular party, which I'm not sure if that's a good idea, to be honest. And that might be something we can touch on in a minute or two, but
I think for myself that I kind of tend on focusing on finding conservative disinformation and trying mm-hmm. to, I don't know. I mean, the last few days with that, you know, Scheer is so poor that brought kind of a bit of joy for me. I saw conservatives getting upset. They never have an issue with the fact that, you know, conservative MPs have called Justin Trudeau stupid, an idiot. They mm-hmm. call him a trust fund baby. And this is what I don't get about the whole trust fund thing. Mm-hmm. Most trust fund kids I know they smoke pot all day. They do drugs. They hang out at their parents' pool or their pool. Or they go on vacations. They don't do anything. They don't want to run a country. They don't want to take on the work. When Justin Trudeau took over the leadership of the Liberal Party, they were in third place. They were a bankrupt party. It was going to take work. I think this whole image of him being a trust fund baby is, I frankly don't think they understand what a trust fund baby is. I've known a few of those people, and they're not running to become prime minister. I mean,
I think what they're doing, and you know, let's give credit where it's due. They're very good with playing people, right? Oh, look at this trust fund baby. You guys are all poor, so you don't like people with money. So that's what I'm getting out of this. They've always done that, right? Where it's perfectly fine to call out opposition or people that don't agree with you. In that way, that, oh, he's a trust fund baby. Oh, he's doing this. Oh, he has a new car. But you never look at the person who's pointing any of that out, right? And that's where the sheer so poor that came out. Because we all recognize that that's not what that is. You know, we know what being working class is. We know what being middle class is. Like, we know what poverty is. So for anybody on either side, whether you're liberal or conservative, but especially in this instance of the conservatives, they always manage to pander to the person in a hypocritical way. And for us, like, to me, it just makes me want to pull my hair out, because that's all you ever see. Being upset that, you know, this hashtag is going around, but not understanding that making $120,000 a year in the 80s is not really like a started from the bottom, now we hear thing. That's not what that is. But every conservative will see it that way. Not every conservative, but they'll see it that way. Yeah, you know, he you know, pulled himself up by the bootstraps. I don't understand why the liberals can't get that. You know, they that's how they operate, and they've managed to do that for a long time. But I think people are starting to point that out a little bit more and just say, hello, pot, meet kettle.
Yeah, and the thing with Scheer is, you know, he became an MP at the age of 24. He ran to become an Ottawa school board trustee when he was 19. He spent 5 or 6 years trying to get into the club before he got into the club. Yep. Now he's in that club, in his own interest, is staying in the club or improving his standing within the club. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw the hashtag, and for me, it was just about to have fun. So I'm going to ask you, you know, Scheer so poor that?
Oh, Scheer is so poor that he could only afford a 21-foot yacht when he joined the yacht club.
Wow. Well played. Mm. And for me, Scheer so poor that he once had to have French's mustard instead of Grey Poupon.
Oh!
You know, for me, if I were to do that joke, it'd be like, Neil's so poor that chasing squirrels in the schoolyard was a school's lunch program.
Oh.
And I'm not making anyone who loves eating squirrels or defense squirrels, no insult to you. But I agree with you. There's nothing we can take for granted this time. My main goal is to engage people to vote. I'm not going to be one of those people on Twitter who goes, if you vote Green or NDP, you're wasting your vote, because that pushes people away.
It does.
Frankly, you know, decide you're going to vote, and then we can convince you on why you should vote for the candidate of your choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone who listens knows that I'm a liberal. I see the numbers are looking good for the liberals, but there's nothing I'm going to take for granted. We need to keep calling out the bullshit, the disinformation, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think you're excellent at that. And I'm happy to have you as part of the Zodcast.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. And I definitely agree with that, where we can't be knocking people that are actually engaged enough to vote, right? Okay, you want to vote Green, you want to vote NDP, that's your prerogative. Like, and always vote with your value, right? Like, if that's what you genuinely believe, then vote for it. That's what you should do. I'm not going to say that, you know, someone should compromise their values for the sake of anything in the political realm. And I kind of, like, when it comes to the politician side of it, that's kind of why we're at where we're at, though, is because they have compromised their values when it has come to votes and policies and that kind of stuff.
So why don't you give us your Twitter handle, because I think you're one of those must follow accounts. So
that's so why nice. Don't you... Thank you.
I can be nice sometimes.
Okay, so my Twitter handle is at Hal, H-A-L, and Lolo, L-O-L-O.
So make sure people listening that you follow that, and on today's episode, I have Max Fawcett. He is a freelance writer, and we're going to be discussing what else? The weather? No. The upcoming federal election, and I can't wait to dig into this further with you, Lauren. Thank you for agreeing to join this podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was super awesome, and I will be very, very happy to come back again.
So it's an absolute pleasure having you on, Max. I'm speaking with Max Fawcett. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and your work, Max?
Oh boy, where do I start? So right now I'm a freelance magazine writer, I guess you could call it, although a lot of the stuff is going online because that's where the eyeballs are these days. But I many, many moons ago worked in politics on the Hill for a Liberal member of parliament named Dennis Mills. So this was back in the early 2000s. We put on the Rolling Stones concert in 2003, among other things, and it was a lot of fun working for him. And then eventually I transitioned into journalism, which led me to Alberta, which led me to magazines, which led me to business, which led me to being the editor-in-chief of Alberta Oil Magazine. Then I went back to where I grew up, Vancouver, to be the editor of Vancouver Magazine, which was owned at the time by Yellow Pages. That didn't turn out to be the world's greatest decision. Yellow Pages was not exactly committed to high-quality journalism. And so back to the freelance world I went and just finished a almost two-year stint at the Alberta Climate Change Office. I left in late January. Moved back to Toronto to take care of an aging parent, and that's where I've been doing my writing from.
And have you received any emails today from people threatening to break your jaw?
I have not, mercifully. I only get those infrequently, so you know that when they come, they're a special occasion. I wouldn't want it any other way.
And especially not from a prospective NDP client. I guess we should discuss this. I was reading today on a I guess I'm not sure if it's a Kamloops.
Kamloops.
Yeah, from Kamloops, basically stating that a NDP candidate, a former NDP candidate, Doc Curry, who was a candidate for Kamloops Thompson, was fired by the party today for online comments. And the story led to you. So maybe tell me how that came about.
Sure. So I feel bad is not the correct word here, but I feel responsible, which I guess is true, because when I found out that Doc was the candidate in Kamloops, I think it's Kamloops Caribou Thompson, I sort of tweeted, you know, hey, if anyone needs any oppo on this candidate, I might have something for you. And the reason was that we had engaged on a mutual friend's Facebook account a couple years ago. We disagreed about pretty much everything, but it, you know, it was a spirited, fun conversation. So, you know, that was fine. We had gotten to talking about, as I think everyone does on social media at some point or another, the Trans Mountain Pipeline. He's, you know, I'm born and raised in Vancouver, but lived in Toronto, and obviously was speaking from my perspective, living a decade in Alberta. And so I supported it. He opposed it very passionately. And so at one point he posted on his Facebook and tagged me, which was a little strange. One day I'm going to break Max Fawcett's jaw. That's not a threat. That's a promise. And so I thought at the time I just posted a little, a kissy face or a little heart underneath his post to, you know, kind of show that I wasn't taking it too seriously, but I screen capped it because whenever someone threatens you, you should probably take a screen cap of it. And you know, it's good to make sure you have these sorts of things just in case. And I didn't really think any more about it until I saw that he was the candidate. And so I made that tweet. I was never going to post it. I was never going to share it. It was kind of a joke because a few people that follow me remember our conversations, our heated conversations. But then I guess the party asked him about it and he told them and they pulled the trigger on him. And you know, so I can't speak to why they did that. I think if it's just that tweet, that's a mistake on their part. That's an overreaction, I think, because he apologized for it. I accepted the apology without reservation because I kind of think that's what you should do. And I think we need to create a space in public life and in politics where people can make mistakes and they can come back from them. They can apologize for them. They can atone. And they can still participate, because if we don't do that, we're going to have the most boring political conversations and the most boring politicians you know, imaginable. It's just going to be bland, milquetoast people who've never kind of expressed a passionate thought, especially when you're young. I mean, that's, you know, a thing that I think that people of a more experienced vintage, let's call it, in this country don't entirely appreciate, is that they got to be teenagers and young adults when there was no real documentation of what they were doing, right? I mean, there was Polaroid cameras, I guess, but you know, pretty hard to keep a Polaroid for 35 years and pretty hard to document much with it. And so they kind of got free rein to make mistakes, learn from their mistakes, become better people. And then once they were entering public life, they kind of had the, not a clean slate, but they had the slate that they wanted. You know, here's my reputation, here's my work, here's this, here's that. In this day and age, we don't have that. You know, we can tweet something dumb when we're 16, or we can Facebook something dumb when we're 20. And someone can bring that back. And if you know, the parties are going to make that a deal breaker for any candidate, that's really kind of limiting the pool of people who can participate in public life. So, I have mixed feelings about this whole thing because, you know, on the one hand, you know, it is what it is, but, you know, it sets a weird precedent that I'm not sure we should be happy about.
And I would agree with that. I'm thankful that I didn't have, being someone who's in their early 40s, I didn't have social media group. And thank goodness, you know, my period where I loved Motley Crue and the period where I had a mullet, yeah. I wouldn't want out there forever. It's bad enough that my mom has those pictures and she threatens me on a weekly basis with them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I agree with what you're saying, because one of the ways that we connected, and on a personal level, I've always been thankful for, you know, when my information was put out there, when certain national news organization wrote an article about me, you reached out and supported me. And I've always been thankful, because there was a few people who said, this is what's going to happen next. This is what's going to happen. Just, you know, get through the first day. And, you know, people tend to judge me based on maybe 20 or 30 tweets that I sent out back when I didn't think anyone was paying attention. And to think that any political door that I would have is closed because of that seems kind of silly to me. And, you know, that being said, you know, other than calling Andrew Coyne a marzipan dildo and telling a few people to F off, I don't think I moved to the I'm going to break your jaw. My thinking is, when I read that, was I don't think this is the entire story. That's kind of what I gathered when I read it, that there may have been other things, or maybe he disclosed other things that would have made them make that decision. But I agree with you. I think that would be an absolutely silly reason to get rid of someone. That being said, it might have been the threat of violence that could have done it. But
yeah, I mean, I'm not going to die on his particular hill, but it's in the, you know, in the same mountain range. Yeah, I'll die there, because I think we need to be willing to give people the opportunity to learn from their mistakes. I don't want elected officials who have always been perfect. I don't want elected officials who have never made a mistake. I would much rather have an elected official who has made a mistake and has learned from it and has become more empathetic and more, you know, thoughtful. I think that person is going to be a better public servant than someone who has kind of aced all the tests in life. So, you know, you and I are kind of part of this growing fraternity of people who have kind of, you know, whether they blew themselves up or someone blew them up on social media. And I think you can respond one of two ways. You can respond by becoming bitter and closing yourself off, or you can respond by trying to be more empathetic and more sympathetic towards other people who go through the same. So, you know, in a weird way, I kind of feel like I have a responsibility to talk about this and say, you know, just because someone said something intemperate on social media is not in and of itself a reason for you to dismiss them. And it might be a reason for you to actually embrace them if they've learned from it. So, you know, that fraternity is only going to get bigger as, the people who become candidates, you know, every 4 years, the candidate set gets 4 years younger, all the things being equal. And that's 4 years closer to the time when people have lived their entire lives on social media.
Exactly. And I agree. You know, my experience has led me to change, you know, to change my wording, but not the I guess not the message, right? To change my demeanor a little bit, maybe not to swear. Actually, it was kind of an agreement I made with my teenage daughter. Don't use the F word anymore. Yeah. So that seemed fair to me, but I find that it's given me a lot more empathy, a lot more direction. And it opened up a world that I didn't really knew existed on social media. Once you start tempering your message a little bit, it's opened up opportunities for me that weren't there before. And I absolutely agree. You know, from reading that story, I didn't look at it as something that, you know, I wouldn't go, oh, look, you know, look what Max got himself, you know, into. Or, you know, I just kind of looked at the story and said, there has to be more than this. And I'm curious as to what happened with Markham as well. But that being said, I think we should be able to learn from our mistakes. Yeah. Now, I saw you wrote an article that was posted on the 11th on the CBC, mm-hmm. Called What Happens if Albertans keep praying for another oil boom, but God has none left to give? And maybe go into that a little bit for me.
You know, I mean, speaking of jaws being broken, I'm definitely asking for it with this one. But, you know, I've been thinking about this for a long time. It's sort of constantly in my thoughts of, you know, how is Alberta going to, what is the future going to look like for Alberta? And I confess that I think about that in part because I have a stake in that, because I'm, you know, I very much want to return to Alberta once the current thing I'm dealing with is dealt with. And I want to live in a place where people are thinking constructively about the future and people are dealing with the world as it is, rather than turning to snitch lines and war rooms and all these other sorts of approaches that are really just ways of ignoring the problem. So, you know, the piece is a two-parter, and in the first piece, it basically identifies the situation that Alberta faces right now, which is there is no politician that can make things the way they used to be. There's a lot of people in Alberta that thought that when Jason Kenney got elected, you know, the jobs would come back, the investment would come back, it would be like it used to be. And it isn't. It's the same. It's probably a little worse, because Alberta, as an oil and gas producer, is part of a global market. And it's a small part. It's not small, but, you know, in a 100 million barrel a day market, it's, you know, less than 5%. So it's not like Saudi Arabia, where it can kind of move the market by itself. It kind of has to play the cards that are being dealt out of the deck. And so the cards have been terrible for the last 4 or 5 years. And I think that, you know, there are some people who think that if they get a new dealer, suddenly the cards will get better. And it's just not the case. There's nothing that Andrew Scheer can do different than Justin Trudeau to make things the way it was 10 years ago in Alberta, where, you know, people were making pretty great money and maybe not working as hard as they do today. And, or, you know, certainly for people who aren't working at all, that's definitely true. But, well, sorry, I guess that doesn't make any sense. They'd be working much harder back then. But anyways, the point is it was a good time in Alberta. You know, the government was giving out prosperity bonuses. You know, people were getting pretty rich if they were, you know, at the right part of the deal cycle, if they were the ones who owned the assets and sold them, you know, they did pretty well. And people really want to go back to that. They really want to go back to that. And the problem is they can't, because that was all about the world thinking that it was running out of oil. You know, back then people would talk about peak oil, you know, in terms of supply peaking. And so you had people like Jeff Rubin, who was the chief economist at, I want to say CIBC, who wrote a book, you know, basically predicting that oil would go to $200 a barrel. That was the consensus, was that, you know, the oil sands were a license to print money that would never run out. And then it did. You know, shale came along, which is this technology, you know, fracking, which is what Elizabeth Warren just pledged to ban if she gets elected president, which is a whole other thing. But basically, you know, it's the layman's version of fracking is you drill holes in the ground, you put pressurized water and chemicals in there, and you kind of, there are these little seams in the earth, and you open the seams up, and the seams, you know, give their oil up, and then the oil flows with the water back to the surface, as opposed to these sort of, you know, the old way, which was you just drill a hole in the ground, stick a, you know, pipe down there and it comes up, or the oil sands, which is, you know, you gather up the sand and heat it and, you know, the sand separates out from the oil. So a new way of producing oil, and suddenly Texas and New Mexico could produce twice as much oil as they did, you know, 10 years ago. It just massively changed the game. It was a game changer. And there's a lot of Albertans who still haven't accepted that the game has changed, or who want the game to change back to the way it used to be. And they think that a, you know, Andrew Scheer can do that. And he can't, you know. Justin Trudeau doesn't hate the energy sector. He doesn't hate Alberta. You know, he bought them a pipeline, for crying out loud. So, he, you know, he's doing, I think, a lot of helpful things. But there's this real anger in Alberta because the game has changed. And so they're directing it at Trudeau. They're directing it. They directed it at Notley. They think that Scheer will save them. And the unpleasant truth is, at the end of the day, the only people who can save them is themselves. And the way they save themselves is by adapting to the new reality, adjusting to the new economic landscape, and making the best of a situation that isn't as good as they want it to be. But it's not all bad. So, you know, I had the second piece which ran today, and it was all about all these other opportunities for growth and prosperity in the energy space, just different kinds of energy, and not all solar and wind either. There's some, you know, liquids coming out of the ground energy stuff. You know, there's lots of new ways to build businesses and be prosperous. But that requires Alberta to kind of put the way things used to be done behind it. And there's just a lot of people who aren't ready to do that yet.
Do you think that they have the leadership in Jason Kenney to get that done? Do you believe he can pivot for that, or is he all in on the old ways?
He could. I mean, you know, there's not much he couldn't do at this point. His support is so wide. He has such a strong mandate. If he wanted to kind of speak truth and say, look, folks, you know, we have to adapt to the way the world is now. And that means, you know, lowering our GHG emissions. That means, you know, reducing our costs. That means accepting that a low carbon economy is a question of when, not if. And he hasn't chosen to do that. He's chosen to build war rooms and do public inquiries and yell at Amnesty International and kind of really play to the crowd. I, you know, it's not what I would like to see, but he clearly thinks it's to his advantage politically. And I kind of don't see any evidence that he's going to change course here, you know, and maybe that's partly informed by the fact that the last conservative premier who tried to do that was Jim Prentice, and he lost the first election that a conservative had lost in over 40 years. You know, he kind of explained that Albertans had to look in the mirror and that, you know, a lot of the problems were kind of their own making, and it was time to stop, you know, spending all the royalties and revenues from oil and gas on programs. It was time to start saving it again. That meant higher taxes. You know, he was ready to have that conversation, and Albertans said they weren't ready to have it with him. So yeah, I kind of understand the reticence from Kenny's perspective, but I think, you know, in the long term, when it's all said and done, the history books will not give him high marks for leadership.
Do you think that part of his, in seeing how I view being highly belligerent in some ways in how he speaks, how he, you know, even his comments that he made where he was kind of looking kindly on how Vladimir Putin dealt with Greenpeace. Now, do you feel that's because he has national aspirations? Is he trying to play the tough guy because he's looking outside of Alberta, or is he just trying to make sure that he keeps his base in Alberta?
I mean, that is the sort of consensus among most of the people I talk to in Alberta who are politically engaged, is that he has at least one eye on the federal job. And is ensuring that if an opportunity opens up there, that he is able to pivot and you know, be able to say to Albertans and to Canadians, look, you know, I love being Premier of Alberta, but, you know, we have to take this fight to Justin Trudeau. And the only way I can do that now is by becoming the leader of the Federal Conservative Party. You know, like, it's not hard to see that there are breadcrumbs being laid down in that direction. But I also think he enjoys playing the tough guy, being the sort of belligerent populist. And it certainly gets a good reaction from a lot of the crowds that he talks to. I mean, look, I get it.
He's effective at it too, though.
He's effective. He's definitely effective. And I mean, look, you know, for a lot of Albertans who are not students of the global energy space and, you know, don't have the time or the inclination to kind of really stay on top of these things, the last 5 years just kind of feel like they've gotten punched in the face repeatedly. You know, a lot of, and this is characteristic of, especially in Calgary in the energy sector, a lot of people who worked in the oil and gas industry also had a majority of their personal investments in the oil and gas industry. And so, you know, when they lost their jobs, not only did they lose their source of income, but their net worth was decimated because, well, not in some cases it was decimated, you know, it was reduced by, you know, far more than 1/10. Sorry, 9/10. Someone's going to get mad at me for that. But, you know, people, it was really a double whammy because not only did they lose their job, but their, you know, their shares of oil and gas companies and their RSPs and their TFSAs, you know, got really hit hard. And so they were angry. They wanted someone to lash out at, to fight back against. And, you know, I think it feels good for them to have a premier who is willing to box some noses. I just don't think that that's going to achieve anything. So it may feel good in the short term to be, you know, making veiled threats against environmentalists and talking about inquiries and snitch lines and the rest of it. That's not going to change the conditions that have created the situation that Albertans face right now. And, you know, part of the two stories that were published on CBC are about kind of really trying to get the conversation shifted in that direction, away from anger and towards a more constructive, solution-oriented dialogue. But as we've seen in the United States, when you have a constructive, solution-oriented dialogue on one side and a sort of angry populist who's willing to whip up people's fears, it's not really much of a contest.
Well, I will definitely link to both of those articles when I post this podcast. I think they're absolutely excellent, and I think you're incredibly brave for speaking truth to that. Now, I guess pivoting, we're talking with Jason Kenney. Let's kind of pivot to what's ongoing now. And have you dropped any writs on people the last few days? Because I've been dropping writs all over the place.
Yeah, no, I can't even use that word now without sort of going into.
Sounds like a rap battle that white people would have, you know, like the latest rap battle you'd ever imagine would be called dropping writs. But all seriousness, I mean, how do you see this election playing out? Because I know that a lot of us are people who look at politics kind of have, this is how it can go, this is how it will likely go. I mean, how do you see things shaking out so far?
So, I mean, my sense is, you know, in cards on the table, I definitely tilt towards the red team. So, you know, that may color my perspective, and people should know that ahead of time. But my rule of thumb has always been that an election is either about change or it's not about change. And that really kind of shapes everything else. So, you know, I remember in 2016 with Hillary, the thing that made me so nervous is it felt to me like a change election, and the Democrats put up the least sort of change-oriented candidate they could have. I mean, certainly she was a woman, and that's a big change, and it's a change that we need to see happen in America. But in terms of her policies, in terms of how familiar she was to people, she didn't really feel like something new. She felt like a continuation of the status quo. And of course, Trump was the most change candidate in political history. So, you know, that's always been how I look at elections is, you know, is it a changed election or is it not? And then the parties should kind of tailor their messaging accordingly. I don't think it is a change election right now in Canada. I could be wrong. And I've certainly seen there was a poll that Abacus did recently that said that sort of upwards of 50% did think it was time for a change, which, you know, that definitely is a point in the change category. But my gut tells me it's not a change election, and my gut tells me that the fact, you know, the weakness of Andrew Scheer and Jagmeet Singh as leaders will make that even more so. You know, there may be some people who are leaning change and who will look at the options and go, yeah, you know what, I'll wait for the next one. And then I'll cast my change ballot. You know, the change phenomenon can be, it's amazing, actually. It's sort of like a collective, it's like this weird mood where everyone kind of just decides all at once the same thing. I remember in Alberta in 2015, you know, over the span of basically a week, you had everyone that I knew go from, yeah, you know, I'm pretty cool with the NDP or, you know, I'm cool with the PCs to, you know what, it's time for a change. And that was kind of it. And by the, you know, there was nothing Jim Prentice could have done beyond that to kind of put that change toothpaste back in the change tube, to butcher that metaphor. So we'll see how this goes. I mean, Trudeau could do or say things that make people want to change. But my sense is everyone's going to be kind of unsatisfied with the outcome. I don't think anyone's getting a majority. I think it'll probably be a minority situation. At which point you could get a reset of one or more of the leaders of the three major parties. I mean, one of the things I do like about Canadian politics is shifts can happen within a campaign period. You know, in the United States, the major shifts are pretty uncommon. But, you know, 2015, we went in thinking that the NDP would do very well, possibly would form a minority government. And they, you know, they crap the bed. So it does matter what happens over the next 6 weeks.
I agree when we talk about the difference between a change election and, I don't know, like I guess I call it like an assessment election where you're assessing the record of. And I felt in 2015 that it was going to be a change. I didn't know who it was going to change to, whether it was going to be the NDP, how strong the Liberals were going to look. I felt that the Conservatives were done as a majority government, though. And I agree with you. I don't get that sense this time. I thought in 2015 there was going to be change. I just wasn't sure what change was going to be there. What do you think? What do you think the main issues of this election campaign are going to be, or are?
Well, I know that the Conservatives are going to try to make ethics an issue. If I was being paid to give them advice, I would say that is a very bad idea. You know, one of my sort of default political beliefs is that no one ever really votes a government out for being corrupt, because most voters assume a certain level of corruption to begin with. You know, I don't think Harper lost because of the In-N-Out scandal or Dean Del Mastro going to prison. I think those were accent notes on a sort of broader sense that it was just time to change the electoral linen and, you know, and have a fresh bed. So I don't think that's going to be the case here. I know that, you know, within the Beltway, you know, within the sort of Ottawa bubble, people are very excited about the SNC issue. I don't think it's going to connect with voters. I think my sense is that, you know, it's a cost of living, you know, making things affordable election, and the Liberals have done some good work there. They have, I think, more work to do. You know, the Conservatives will be talking a lot about the carbon tax, and that will sort of, I think, be one of their big affordability messages. And it's, you know, much as it pains me to say it, it's an effective one. It shouldn't be, because, you know, the facts are pretty clear about the impact on affordability, but they've done a very good job of filling that message space before the Liberals got in there. And so I think we'll hear a lot about that. I think at the end of the day, though, you know, I think maybe the Liberal message, you know, in the last week or so will be one of, you know, with all the uncertainty in the world, with Brexit, with Trump, with, you know, China, do you really want to try a new leader right now? Is now the time for a change? And I think a lot of Canadians will agree with that and say, you know what, not now, not yet, because, you know, the economy's doing pretty well. There have been some, you know, especially for parents, they've made some changes that have been very beneficial to parents. You know, Canadians are doing pretty well, you know, in terms of compared to other people around the world. Are they doing as well as they could? Maybe not. But I sometimes think that the conservative strategy is being warped by the anger in Alberta and Saskatchewan. They're letting that color their view of the country as a whole. And I just don't think that's how people in Ontario and Quebec feel right now, or BC. I don't think they feel the way people in prairies do. And so messages that try to sort of suggest that, you know, that the country is in crisis, or that, you know, that things are terrible, they're just going to come off as kind of tone deaf in as it happens, the places with the most seats.
Well, Max, it's an honor and pleasure to speak with you. And again, I want to thank you for, you know, what you did for me when I had kind of my moment of social media reckoning. And I took solace a lot in the article that you wrote about your mistake. I'd like to thank you for coming on, for taking the time and speaking with me, and
appreciate it
for being part of the Zodcast. It was I was speaking with there's another podcast. This is Van Color, it's called. That when I was saying that I had you on, he's like, "Good pull, I love Max." So
well, they should have me on. I love that podcast.
I think that they were saying they're trying to get you on. So look at me, I'm playing matchmaker too now. Have a great day, and thanks for coming on.
You too. Thanks for having me on.
And up next, I have an autism advocate named Malini, who is going to talk about some of the bad changes that are happening for the parents of autistic children in the Ottawa area. Alini is a concerned citizen worried about the recent developments on the Ontario Autism Program introduced by the Conservative government, which creates insurmountable barriers to access needs-based behavioral therapy. She's the mother of two children, one of whom is autistic and currently receiving services. On a personal note, I became aware of Alini through her advocacy and activism regarding the Ontario Autism Program, and it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you finally.
Thank you.
Pleasure so, fine. Yes, I'm a huge fan of your work on Twitter. I'm a huge fan of your activism. You're a go-to account for me. And thank you for coming on the hot mess known as a Zodcast. Just to kind of get things started, I became aware today of, I guess, CHEO released their fall services for the autism program today. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we're missing from it apparently was comprehensive ABA. So maybe you can explain comprehensive ABA, what it means for the children who are receiving it, and I guess maybe just talk about your experiences.
Yes, of course. So so comprehensive ABA, it currently refers to what used to be IBI, intensive behavioral intervention, which is a type of behavioral therapy that seeks to provide children with essential skills to, be participants of society, to gain skills to communicate, to gain skills to safely handle themselves on the streets, like to cross the street looking at both sides, not putting themselves in danger, and most importantly, refrain from getting into dangerous behaviors or attitudes. If someone else just says, you need to stop, you need to listen, don't play with this because it might be dangerous. So pretty much increase compliance with safety regulations that are imposed by society, right? So it refers, comprehensive ABA, it entails actually, lengthy weeks of therapy. So usually it depends on the needs. It's a needs that are proposed clinically by a clinical therapist. He or she will say your child would benefit to participate in intensive therapy, either within 25 hours a week or up to 40 hours a week. So CHIO, which is our local hostel for children, used to offer the comprehensive behavior, comprehensive ABA, until apparently today. So under the previous program, the child would be, you would receive a, you know, how would I say, a therapist would say your child requires 25 hours and then you'd go to CHIO and you'd service this program. As of now, apparently new children who may be in need of comprehensive ABA, they will no longer be able to purchase those services through CHIO. So our local hospital no longer is offering, public hospital no longer is offering those services. They will be only provided by for-profit providers and, private providers, better speaking.
Hey, now, I mean, from your experience, from your knowledge of how this government has handled this file, the Ontario Autism Program, and everything surrounding it, do you think this reduction of services at CHIO for autistic children is a direct result of the Ford government?
Absolutely, yes. So what happens is, with the new program that the government introduced in February the 6th, they introduced what we call the childhood budgets, which is some sort of funding that is not based on need. So they pretty much give families who have kids with autism or autistic kids either $20,000 a year or $5,000 depending on the age. So if the child is 6 and over, he or she would receive, the parents, the family would receive $5,000. Or if the child is under 6 years old, he or she would receive $20,000. The thing is, this amount, this funding, is absolutely insufficient to buy these services, this comprehensive ABA, which is very costly and can cost up to $84,000, $90,000 a year. So it's not that the demand is not there for these services. It's just regular families, middle class, and even, you know, upper middle class families have difficulties to afford to pay these services, even with the current government support. So it has decreased the demand, but not because of the lack of need. The need is still there, but the demand has decreased because there is no longer, people don't have money. They don't have the means to afford these services. The funding is insufficient. So I imagine that CHIO, roll back this program because just there is not enough people that can afford that sort of program. So the government, both the previous minister, Lisa McLeod, and the current minister, Todd Smith, both of them signaled that the market would, you know, fix itself because we have seen throughout Ontario therapists losing their jobs, service providers, diminishing the amount of intake that they're having or the services that they're providing. We noticed that the market's not, fixing themselves. They are just stopping to offer this service because the demand is not there. The demand is there. Many kids need these services. It's just families cannot afford these services. So we are really, removing access to services that are of essential. They're essential for kids and families for, you know, increase the skills, integrate them more fully into, let's say, the school system and whatnot. Yeah. So it's absolutely, there is no question that the lack of offer of these services now have to do with the new changes that the current government has introduced back in February. Yes.
What can we do, Aline, we have an election in Canada right now. What can we do to bring this fight, because that's what it is now, how can we make this an issue in the upcoming federal election? Is there a path that you see for that? Or are you going to, do you feel that this is an appropriate platform to bring up the cause, your cause, and the cause of so many other Ontarians? Is this an appropriate time? Is this the time that we should be kind of gearing up the fight?
Well, I think there are two issues there. The first is an issue that it clearly is part of the specific agenda of the Conservatives, right? Small government, privatization of services. People have to realize what this privatization of services, what they entail. We are not just talking about services not being offered by by the government and being provided by private service providers, but the fact that this privatization may create barriers not only for low-income individuals and middle class as well, but all sorts of barriers. We're talking about Canada, a country in which we have a massive immigration here, 20% of the population are immigrants, foreign-born. When we're talking or moving access to these services solely to the market, we have to take into consideration language barriers. We have to take into consideration cultural barriers that may be imposed by the market. We're talking about a contract. We're talking about the shift of individuals instead of being, bearers of rights to access services, they're now understood to be clients. So I think it's appropriate to think about the consequences of privatization. And I think that there are certain, platforms, programs that speak more about that or advocate more for that than others. And the other thing is, the way that I see, at least for families with autistic individuals who need this sort of services, is perhaps to push political parties, the federal parties, to give a statement about their commitment to create some sort of a national strategy. Because what we see is, a new government enters, a new government goes, and it can completely change the face of the Ontario Autism Program. And every 4 years, families are now fighting over and over again. And that's extremely frustrating. That's exhausting. That creates actually trauma, depression, crisis. So if we have something that is established beyond the provincial level, something that we may feel that may stay in there or you have a longer continuity, and not only that, that will be some sort of homogeneous across all provinces, right? Autism services are extremely heterogeneous depending on where you are. So I think for me and for many others within the community, the way I see it, we are pushing towards a national strategy, something that creates some sort of an instability. And it's not so passive to, the whims and wishes of specific local politicians, provincial politicians and whatnot.
Yeah. So something ingrained more like in the Canada Health Act, something like a national autism strategy that's negotiated between the provinces and the federal government.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way. Well, at least that's what I personally, I can speak for the community, would like to see,
So, I guess kind of in closing, if let's just say that Todd Smith or the federal health minister were listening right now, what would you want to say directly to them about what you've experienced and what you're feeling?
If I could say is, I just do not understand why they choose to continue with a program, an interim plan, a plan as of now, that they themselves acknowledge it was a mistake. So the childhood budget was acknowledged as a plan that, you know, it doesn't look for needs. It is wasteful. It is insufficient for many families. It's wasteful for families that don't need that sort of money. So it's not based allocated on need. And yet, even though the program is, you know, it's rolled out on April 1st, they still decided to go with it until April next year, which does not make any sense for the fact that we have to develop a number of institutional knowledge, a number of procedures, a number of templates of how to communicate with families and whatnot. That costs money, that costs time, and that will be thrown out by April 2020, apparently, right? When they come up with a new plan. Instead of just going back to the previous liberal plan, that we already had the capacity, that we already had the knowledge on how that goes. People already know how it works. People already knew what to expect. It seems that, you know, they're too proud to acknowledge that it would be better to go back to the liberal plan and scrap this whole new plan that they put it in place, that they will just get rid of anyway. So if I were to say anything to, you know, the minister, Todd Smith, is please leave your pride aside for the sake of families, for the sake of children, for the sake of taxpayers, because this plan is just so incredibly wasteful. They are insufficient. Families are still under distress. And this plan, as it continues, is pushing providers to keep from providing those services, such as comprehensive ABA. So just leave your pride behind and, you know, just acknowledge that it was a mistake to get rid of the previous plan, which was the liberal plan, and work from there instead of continue with this mess that is the childhood budget. I have not heard anyone to say a good thing about this yet.
Aline, I want to thank you for your activism. I'm sorry for the ignorance and hatred and, pardon my language, bullshit that you face on a regular basis, people like yourself and Hannah, that you face online from people who don't understand or who are too ignorant to understand. And I want to thank you for being the voice of so many others and for motivating people like myself to get involved. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
No, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you, Neil. Thank you for giving this platform to raise this issue. It's a issue that is pressing, and I just feel that it's lagging, and you know, families are really suffering. And thank you for just listening. Thank
you. And for anyone listening to this bit, make sure that you tweet at or message on Facebook Todd Smith and ask these same very questions that we're asking today. Once again, I'd like to thank Lauren Griffith, Max Fawcett, and Aline for appearing on this week's podcast. Please make sure to rate or subscribe to my podcast and other great podcasts at FU Politics. That's the 4U Network. As always, if you have any compliments or suggestions, please feel free to reach me on Twitter at That's Mr. Neil. If you have any complaints, you can also reach me on Twitter. My name is Lisa McLeod. That's at McLeod Lisa. Thank you very much for listening.
Kneel before Zod!
This is fun! The FU Network!